Good morning, Renewal. Today we're going to be reading Matthew chapter 23, verses 1 through 12 and 23 to 28 in the NIV. I'll give you a moment to pull that up or find it, and it will be up on the screen as well. Then Jesus said to the crowds and to his disciples, "The teachers of the law and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat, so you must be careful to do everything they tell you. But do not do what they do, for they do not practice what they preach. They tie up heavy, cumbersome loads and put them on other people's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to lift a finger to move them. Everything they do is done for people to see. They make their phylacteries wide and the tassels on their garments long. They love the place of honor at the banquets and the most important seats in the synagogues. They love to be greeted with respect in the marketplaces and to be called rabbi by others. But you are not to be called rabbi, for you have one teacher, and you are all brothers. And do not call anyone on earth father, for you have one father, and he is in heaven. Nor are you to be called instructors, for you have one instructor, the Messiah. The greatest among you will be your servant, for those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You give a tenth of your spices, mint, dill, and cumin, but you have neglected the more important matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faithfulness. You should have practiced the latter without neglecting the former, you blind guides. You strain out a gnat, but swallow a camel. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You clean the outside of the cup and dish, but inside they are full of greed and self-indulgence. Blind Pharisee, first clean the inside of the cup and dish, and then the outside also will be clean. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You are like whitewashed tombs, which look beautiful on the outside, but on the inside are full of the bones of the dead and everything unclean. In the same way, on the outside you appear to people as righteous, but on the inside you are full of hypocrisy and wickedness." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Good morning. Thank you for being here on this daylight saving Sunday. You made your way, so I'm thankful. This is also Lent, which means we've fasted 1 hour of the day, probably unwittingly, but we have nevertheless fasted, and so thank God that we can be here. And we're also missing the college students. It's spring break, and college students, if you are really spiritual, as I know you are, and you're listening to the podcast and keeping up with the sermons, we miss you. Today we're going to be looking at Jesus and the Pharisees. As we begin, I'd like for you to think about a relationship where somebody who loves you told you no. Not a stranger, not an authority figure, but somebody who genuinely cares about you. Maybe it's a parent who said, "I won't bail you out one more time." Or maybe it's a spouse who said, "I can't let you keep doing this to our marriage." Maybe it's a friend who told you something true about yourself that you didn't want to hear, but you needed to. In that moment, it can feel like a rejection, right? But we know, if we are honest, that a love which never says no is not really love. It's conflict avoidance. It's because the relationship is being shown to be, it's an arrangement of convenience, not a real friendship, not real love. It's keeping the peace at the cost of a relationship. Real love can oppose you because real love is invested in who you are and who you are becoming. It's not just interested in keeping you appeased or comfortable. So, in today's text, we heard Jesus say some genuinely difficult things. Matthew 23 contains some of the sharpest words of Jesus in the Gospels. 7 times in this chapter, Jesus pronounces, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites." And these are not the gentle, compassionate words that we are accustomed to hearing from him, right? But if we are going to hear this text for ourselves, not just as a story about some ancient religious villains, but as word that's addressed for us today, we need to receive it in the way that we will receive hard words from somebody who loves us. We need to receive it as the honesty of a doctor who names our condition, our true condition, so that we can actually get on the road to healing. These are not the words of a prosecutor, they're the words of a father. So, over the past several weeks in this series, we've been watching Jesus pursue the lost, the broken, the people that everybody else had written off. He had pursued the woman at the well, he pursued Zacchaeus, the tax collector, he pursued the woman caught in adultery. And again, Jesus went to the margins and brought people home, and they embraced them. But today's text is starkly different, isn't it? Jesus is not with the outsiders. In fact, he's with the ultimate insiders, the most respected, the most devout, the most religiously successful people in his world. And his tone is hard. So the question that we need to wrestle with throughout the sermon is this. What if the people who need the most urgent word from Jesus are not the obvious sinners, but the obvious saints? What if our greatest obstacle to grace is not our failure, but our righteousness? Here's the first part of the sermon. Piety, performance, and the people that we think we're not. So here's the first problem we need to contend with before this text can speak to us. We already know who the Pharisees are. They're the bad guys. They're the villains in the gospel story. They're in the background whispering and plotting while Jesus is saving the day. And we've known this since Sunday school days. And so most of us come to Matthew 23 with this quiet certainty that Jesus is talking about them, not us. That certainty is precisely what needs disturbing. Because the Pharisees were not obvious villains. They were the most serious, the most devout, the most biblically rigorous people of their day. They fasted twice a week, and we struggled to fast during Lent. They tithed so scrupulously, they went into their cupboards, and they tithed their garden herbs. We are struggling to tithe our paychecks. They knew their scripture inside and out. They built their entire lives around obedience to God's law. They were so concerned about breaking God's law that they built additional laws so that, in order for them to break God's law, then they would have to break the other laws. If you asked any first century Jewish person who the truly godly people were, then they would have pointed to the Pharisees, no hesitation. So if the Pharisees were around today, they would be the most celebrated Bible teachers, the most respected leaders in Christian circles. You would go to them for their intimate knowledge of the Bible, their expertise on godly living, their faithful leadership. You would be subscribing to their podcasts and be listening to them all the time. Give an exam on spiritual seriousness, and the Pharisees would be passing with flying colors. So here's the great irony of the Gospels. Of all of the first century Judaism, of all of the people, you would have expected the Pharisees to be Jesus' natural allies. They were the ones, they were the ones who knew intimately the scriptures that Jesus said he came to fulfill. They had been waiting, they had been studying, they had been praying for the Messiah. They were the best positioned, the best prepared, the most equipped to recognize him, but they were the ones who ended up putting him on the cross. The people with the most Bible knowledge engineered the crucifixion of the God that the Bible is about. If that doesn't unsettle our confidence in religious expertise as a guarantor of spiritual health, I don't know what will. How does this happen? How does this happen? Because expertise in the Bible and just your standing among spiritual circles can not only be used to pursue God, but it can be used to pursue power and privilege. It can be used for the cause of human pride. N.T. Wright points out that the Pharisees' devotion to Torah observance was never purely spiritual. It was also deeply political. They liked being rigorous about the law because it served their nationalist ambitions. You know, it enabled them to mark out who was truly God's elect, who's truly God's people, who's in, who's out, who's clean, and who had compromised. And because they were the ones who were to make that judgment, it gave them tremendous power as the gatekeepers of all of the things of God, right? Who are seated on the seat of Moses. And Jesus came. In the midst of that, Jesus comes, and he comes proclaiming that the ingathering of the excluded and the marginalized, all the people that had banished from the community of God, this all of them gathering in, this truly is the intention of God's law. Grace, not privilege, is the goal of the law of God, and that is what causes the collision. That's why the Pharisees saw Jesus not as the fulfillment of scriptures, not even an ally, but as a threat. I want us to feel the weight of what is being said. The longer that we've been at church, the more like the Pharisees we can become. Not because church is bad, not because knowing more about scriptures or theology is bad. In fact, these are all good and necessary things. But because sustained religious practice without sustained self-examination produces this kind of pathology. It produces a growing confidence not in God, but in our own standing. It produces a drift from dependence on God towards our performance. A shift over time in which God becomes less a father that we're running to and more of a status that we've attained. Our faith, just like the Pharisees, can harden from a relationship into a reputation. Now, this drift is not obvious. It's hard to catch with our naked eye. Pharisaism is not something that we say we are going to become like the Pharisees and that we're going to imitate them. It's not a destination that we are choosing. But this is actually the most natural trajectory of a self-centered heart, given religious tools to work with, isn't it? Because at every stage of the faith journey, when you are a new convert who become perhaps proud of your own conversion, you know, what a testimony, and people heap praises on you, and that's encouraging, but it can also become a source of your self-righteousness. Or the growing disciple who they love gaining more knowledge of scripture and of theology, and then they become proud of it. The mature saint, many years looking over their faithfulness, they become proud of their faithfulness. See, this turn towards self-righteousness, it's an ever-present temptation. It's always available, always dressed in virtue. We don't drift into Pharisaism by becoming less serious about God. We drift into it by becoming serious about God in a way that becomes serious about ourselves. This is why the correction is not just occasional, but constant. There ought to be a lifelong recalibration back towards grace, back to life of gratitude, and away from performance and pride. The question that this text poses to us is not, what was wrong with those Pharisees? The question is, what in me is more Pharisee than I realize? Because the bad guys in the Bible stories are easy to spot. What's hard is spotting the bad guys in ourselves. What if the greatest obstacle to grace is not our failure, or our righteousness? Second part. Jesus comes and he exposes the gap. Jesus is the spiritual doctor here. And he begins his diagnosis in verse 3. He says, the Pharisees do not practice what they preach. What he's saying is there's a gap between the public performance and the private reality. Now, the solution, when we hear things like this, then our solution oftentimes is we got to just try harder. You know, try more effort, try harder to close the gap. Jesus actually is pointing to something deeper than inconsistency. In verse 4, he says, they tie up heavy, cumbersome loads and put them on other people's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to lift a finger to move them. And what he's pointing out is that the law had become a tool for their status and for their control, sorting people into those who measure up and those who don't, with the Pharisees doing the measuring. And then in verse 5-7, Jesus describes the performative nature of their religion. They make a show of all of the symbols that communicate their status as religious people. The phylacteries, the tassels. And then they love the places of honor, and they crave the greeting of rabbi in public. Jesus says everything that they do is done for people to see. The performance has become the point. Then in verse 23 comes this charge. You give a tenth of your spices, mint, dill, and cumin, but you have neglected the more important matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faithfulness. You should have practiced the latter without neglecting the former. And, Jesus is quoting from Micah 6:8. What does the Lord require of you? To do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. So he's pointing out that the Pharisees are keeping exacting logs of all of the minor obediences. And they do this in order to prove their zeal. But the heart of the law is missing. Their inside is a well-hidden disaster. And so he says, you strain out a gnat, but swallow a camel. Majoring in the minors, completely missing the major. All of the scrupulous details were smokescreens, hiding a desperate need for a redeemer. And then in verse 27 comes Jesus' defining image. You are like whitewashed tombs, which look beautiful on the outside, but on the inside are full of bones of the dead and everything unclean. And you see, Jesus is not trying to be insulting. He's offering a diagnosis. Beautiful on the outside, but death on the inside. And a person who's lost sight of the gap between the two. The whitewashed tomb is an image not of deliberate deception, but it's an image of disconnection. So complete that we can no longer notice it. The Pharisees' very competence in religion has shielded him from the one diagnosis that every human heart needs. I'm not okay. I need a savior. This is why the tax collector and the sex worker had an advantage to the Pharisee, not because their sin was less serious, but because their sin was obvious. You know, they couldn't manage their image into respectability, but the Pharisees hid their sin so well behind their virtue that they lost touch with the reality of their sin entirely. You can't repent of what you're convinced you're not guilty of. So hypocrisy here isn't mainly about lying to others, but lying to yourself. It's self-deception. It happens slowly, one whitewashed layer at a time. Religious performance becomes a substitute over time for honest self-examination until you start to believe the performance is the real thing. So here's the third part. It's two worlds, two ways, and the bridge between the worlds. The difference between Jesus and the Pharisees wasn't just a difference of degree, as though Jesus were nicer, you know, he was more merciful version of the same religion. You could say that they're on two entirely different worlds. Asian Americans are so much better represented today in pop culture now than in the 90s. So when the movie The Joe Luck Club came out in 1993, and this was based on the novel by Amy Tan, This is a huge deal for all of the Asians. And they say, whoa, we got Asians in movies now. And it follows four Chinese immigrant mothers and their American-born daughters. And the central point of tension in the movie is the gulf that exists between the generations. Because the mothers, they come from a world of sacrifice, suffering, and survival. And then the daughters, on the other hand, they're brought up in a world of freedom and possibility. And they love each other deeply, but they can't seem to reach each other. You know, it's like they live in two different worlds. The mothers long to be understood, but the daughters just don't get them. Real communication seems like it's going to take a miracle. And that's what it looks like here in Matthew 23. Jesus and the Pharisees are not just disagreeing about religious details and practices. They're living on entirely different worlds here. The Pharisees live in a world of human effort where righteousness is achieved through rigorous observance, where standing before God is earned by performance. But where the question that hangs over everything is always, have you done enough? And it's an exhausting world because in this world, there's no assurance. Is there? But Jesus is offering a different world. As Paul would say, he became a curse for us so that we might become the righteousness of God. Where the Pharisees laid heavy burdens on others and lifted no finger to help, Jesus took himself. Our burdens, the full weight of the Lord's demands, and all of its penalties, so that all of its requirement could not be met, not by our performance, but by his. He doesn't just simply set aside the law. He doesn't just say, it doesn't matter. He fulfills it completely on our behalf. And because of that, he offers what no system of works righteousness could ever offer. Not just forgiveness, but a finished righteousness offered as a gift. You see, every other religion offers the world of the Pharisees, including some forms of Christianity, where if you just dig below the surface, Jesus and his offer of grace are completely missing. Keep these rules, you'll be saved. Observe these practices. Join this theological camp. Toe this line. Accumulate enough merit. Maybe you will make it in, but it's never certain. The ledger never gets closed. Only Jesus can offer something that is different. Not try harder, but it is finished. Not keep the law and live, but I've kept it for you. Not a whitewashed tomb, but a brand new heart. A genuine transformation that comes from within. You know, this is what the law was always pointing towards, but it couldn't produce it. Only Jesus can. The Pharisees heard this offer, but they couldn't receive it. They couldn't even understand it. They were like the mothers and daughters, they're missing each other across this unbridgeable gulf. Grace to a person whose entire identity is built on works righteousness doesn't sound like good news. It sounds like a threat. Because it sounds like everything that they work for is now getting swept aside. If they were to hold on to their world, their system of righteousness, then they had to bury grace. They had to defeat it. And so Matthew 23 ends with a heartbroken Jesus crying out to the Pharisees. He says, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who killed the prophets and stoned those sent to you, how often I have longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you are not willing. Jesus, he's expressing, he longs to gather the Pharisees into his arms. He still longs for his stubborn, self-righteous, rebellious children to be gathered into his arms. Here's the final part. It's the party, the plea, and the sun outside. In verses 8 through 12, Jesus offers an alternative to Pharisaism. He offers not a new version of the same religion, but an entirely new identity. He says to his disciples, you're not to be called rabbi, for you have one teacher, and you're all brothers. and the greatest among you will be your servant. For those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. It's a different system altogether. This is Jesus' kingdom of grace. You don't earn your position. You don't work for your standing. You can't. It's not possible, but you are granted. You're gifted a place. Not because of your record, but because of Jesus' record. You're a child. You're a learner. You're a dependent. The cure for Pharisaism is not more sincerity. It's not more effort. It's receiving a new identity, received as a gift rather than earned through your performance. When the Pharisees were grumbling that received sinners and ate with them, he told them a parable. The parable of the prodigal son, or more precisely, the parable of the two lost sons. We're probably more familiar with the younger son's story. He takes his inheritance early. He goes away and squanders it all, ends up feeding pigs. So he comes to his senses. And so he walks home, practicing his apology to his father. Now the father sees him from afar off, and he runs to him. He throws a robe on his shoulders, puts a ring on his finger, and he throws a party for him. Now, I once heard about a preacher who told this story differently. In his version, when the younger son came home, the father turned to the older son, the faithful one, the one who stayed, the one who never brought shame upon the family, and he honored him instead. He puts the robe on the older son, the ring on the older son's finger, and he throws a party for the older son. And somebody in the church stood up and yelled, "That's how the story should have ended." And there it is. That flash of righteous satisfaction. Law-keeping being rewarded, and wastefulness being turned away. That's the Pharisee inside all of us. That's the older son. And Jesus told this parable for the older son. Because the older son has been keeping a ledger. He's been keeping a record all through this time. He says to the father, "Look, all these years, I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed any of your orders. But you never gave me even a young goat so that I can celebrate with my friends." Service, obedience, the account that should have been built up in his favor. He believes that the father owes him, and the grace shown to his younger brother feels like robbery. Feels like it's a theft. He's been living in his father's house all of his life, and he doesn't understand his father's heart at all. And the father goes out to him, and he says, just as he's run to the younger son, "My son, you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad, because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." That's the plea of Jesus to the Pharisees. You are always with me. Everything I have is yours, but you have to come inside. You have to stop keeping score. You have to let the grace that found your brother find you also. You might not think that you need finding, but you need to be found. And the parable ends without telling us whether the older son went in. Jesus leaves it open because the Pharisees are still deciding, and so are we. See, Pharisaism isn't just a religious disease that afflicts religious people. It's a human one. Think of how many good, righteous causes begin with genuine moral conviction and desire for the world to change for the better, but over time becomes a system of who's in and who's out. Ways to exercise power and control over others through rules and regulations and requirements not so that you can serve or bless, but so that you can prop up performance and privilege and prestige. You know, this happens everywhere. It happens in politics, happens in parenting, happens in cultural identity. You know, because this is Philly, we can even say, well, I keep it real, not like these speakers, and turn that into a way to be a Pharisee. We all have in us this instinct to take a genuine good and weaponize it into a burden. So for all of us, the question is the same. Are we imitating the Pharisees, imposing on others standards that we don't even keep ourselves, using a genuine good as a weapon of judgment? Or are we imitating Jesus, offering grace, carrying burdens alongside of others, showing the mercy that we have received? I want to offer us some questions so that we can take our own temperature. And I would like for us to sit with them this week a little bit. Do I find it easier to confess past sins rather than the present ones? Because old failures are safe to confess, you know, because they're evidence of my growth. Current struggles, they tend to stay private. And that's the whitewash going on. When someone I consider less faithful receives a blessing, is my first instinct joy? Or is it a quiet sense that something unfair has happened? That's the older son at the edge of the party with arms crossed. Am I placing expectations on people around me that I don't fully meet myself? In my family, my workplace, in my community, am I the one that's adding the weight instead of helping to carry it? When did I last feel my need for grace as urgently as I did when I first came to faith? If it's been a long time, it might not be because I've grown spiritually. It might be because the whitewash has gotten thicker. Do I come to God as a child running home, or as an employee presenting a performance review? These produce entirely different kinds of prayers, entirely different kinds of relationships. Do I get dismayed when I feel that I don't get sufficient recognition and people's praise for the righteous things that I have done? And perhaps it's telling us that I have rejoiced more, I have loved more people's praise rather than the life with God and serving Him. The goal here isn't to try to make us feel worse. The goal is to get us to be honest. And honesty is the only posture from which grace can actually reach us. So we've been on a journey in this series. We saw Jesus pursue the lost, and we've rightly seen ourselves in them. But today's text asks something harder of us, doesn't it? We're also the Pharisees. Admired and respected on the outside, but full of pain and darkness on the inside. We've been sitting with this question all morning. What if our greatest obstacle to grace is not our failure, but our righteousness? Here's the answer that the gospel gives. Every system of religion, every system of righteousness ultimately asks, have you done enough? And the honest answer, when you're in your bed in the dark of night, when the performance stops, is always, it's impossible. To meet that standard, is no matter how hard I might try, the ledger is never settled. Only Jesus answers it differently. He says, it is finished. Not by you, but by Him. And that's the offer that extends to every Pharisee inside each one of us. Trying to live up to a standard you can't live up to is exhausting. It's anxious. It's lonely. Jesus offers His kingdom of grace instead, so that we can be freed from this impossible burden. If we're outside of that house with our arms crossed because we've been keeping score, demanding that burdens rather than grace be placed upon people, then you need to hear the father's plea. Comes to us, as he pleads to the older brother, come home and be included in my grace. The father in the parable doesn't just send a message. He doesn't wait inside for the son to come in. He goes out, down to the road to the younger son, and he goes to the field to the older one. And that is what Jesus is doing with us still. He's not waiting for us to get ourselves sorted out. He's already outside, already moving towards us, already pleading with us. And so the only question for us is whether we will stop performing, stop scoring, stop whitewashing long enough so that he can reach us with his grace. Let's pray.